The transfiguration in modern slang. Shut up. No way. Are you for real right now? That was so random. So totally awesome. So epic. Or in the words of Chandler, in that memorable episode where Phoebe and Rachel found something in his closet he didn't want them to find, and he stood and shook his body and waved his hands and said, "That did not just happen." But it did. And lots could be said about what happened on the Mount of Transfiguration. And of course, I've always got to make choices in a brief message. And so today what I'd like to do is bring it to our Lenten focus. And that is to say that whatever darkness we might find ourselves in from moment to moment as we go through life, whatever pain, whatever confusion might be happening, that there is always this glorious reality that sits behind the seen world, that's in the unseen world, this truly glorious being who is always already there. Now, that could just be some theology proper, you know, we could just be talking about omnipresence or something. So let's see if we can scratch a little deeper and wonder, so what? Like, what difference does this make? And as I thought about it this week, I had a memory of being, I don't know, 2, 3, 4 years old or something, down at the beach. I can't remember if it was on the pier or in the harbor or something. And remember when you were a little kid and you discovered those binoculars you could look through? And you begged mom and dad for a quarter, a dime, or a nickel, or whatever it was, right? And you stood on the little round thing that made you, you know, big enough to be able to peer through them. And all of a sudden, like, reality was different to you. You could see things that you'd not been able to see before. And so you keep begging mom for a quarter, right? Until finally she says, "That's enough, come on, let's go," and drags you away. Or can you remember, I don't know, I can't remember when this happens, but is it 5th, 6th, 7th grade or something, when the first time you get to look through a microscope at a hair or a little piece of sand or something? And suddenly you're aware. It's like the looking glass discloses to us that there's an unseen reality that we don't always see. And this says to us that everything now has a different potential than what I thought. And we don't normally think of these words of Paul. They get lost in what's often known as the love chapter, you know, that you hear quoted at weddings and stuff, you know, 1 Corinthians 13, and, you know, all those attributes of what love actually is and how it displays itself. Well, you might remember that at the end of that chapter, Paul says, "We don't yet see things clearly. We're squinting in a fog, peering through a mist. But it won't be long before the weather clears and the sun shines bright. We'll see it all then, as clearly as God sees us." And so something like this is what's happening at the Transfiguration, where the veil that exists between our realm and God's disappears. And this is actually very important for your own walk, for your own Christian spirituality, because so often we think of heaven as a place wherever God is, you know, somewhere up there beyond the stars or something like that. But heaven, the intention of the word heaven in the New Testament is not that kind of physicality. It's not spatial, you know, S-P-A-T-I-A-L. It's not a spatial term. It's meant to say something more like this. There's a human realm, you know, and we're all, right? We're all good with that. We all understand the human realm. So heaven is simply the realm of God. And that realm is never far off. As the scriptures say, in him we live and move and have our being. It would be better, if you wanted metaphorically, to think of the realm of God as something like the air that surrounds us. So there's God's realm and there's our realm. And occasionally, throughout the scriptures, that the divider between that realm, whatever it is, gets very thin. And sometimes it simply disappears. And like looking through a microscope, we see what's always there. Are you feeling me here? We see what's always there, but that without the help of this momentary experience with the microscope, we wouldn't see it. Well, the context, I think, for the Transfiguration is what leads me down this road for our Lenten thinking this year. And that is that in Matthew 16, in the chapter previous, it says that Jesus began to show his disciples that he must go to Jerusalem and suffer many things and be killed. And then he said to them, as that conversation was over, "Truly I say to you, there are some standing here who will not taste death until they see the Son of Man coming in his kingdom." And then the transfiguration happens. And then the passage after the transfiguration, you have kind of this allusion to darkness, the transfiguration, and then later in chapter 17, another bit of darkness where Jesus says to them, "The Son of Man is about to be delivered into the hands of men, and they'll kill him, and he'll be raised on the third day." And the disciples were greatly distressed. So you've got this announcement that distresses them, and this announcement that further distresses them. This darkness, pain, confusion, angst, anxiety. And in the middle of that is this unspeakable light, where they get a taste of Jesus' promise. Where, well, I mean, we can't even really wrap our heads around this. What does it mean, you know, this analogy that his face shined like the sun and his clothes emanated a light that was equal to or beyond the sun? I mean, I'm sure this is just the best language these guys had to describe what they were seeing in front of them. Well, in the middle of this revelation, a voice from the cloud says, "This is my beloved Son. With him, I am well pleased. Listen to him." Now, it's worth noting, I think, that only twice in all of the scriptures did God speak directly in an audible voice to humankind, twice. And both times he said, "Listen to my Son. Place your confidence in him. Accept his words as representing reality as it really is." That what his three friends experienced on the Mount of Transfiguration was Jesus' moment-by-moment existence. I hope you caught that. Because if you want to learn French and someone says, "Listen to him or her," it begs the question, do they know French? And so when God says, "Listen to him," it's not like it's not abstract theology. It's highly relational. And it represents a reality that's always there and always true. We just don't always have the binoculars to see it. But what blew the disciples' minds was Jesus' moment-by-moment reality from the eternal second person of the Trinity forward. He always lived in that glory with God. He just, as Paul said, so that we wouldn't all be blinded, metaphorically speaking, set some of that aside to incarnate himself with us. And later, when we read Peter's thinking about this in 2 Peter, Peter says, "I want you to know this is what happened to us. We're not following cleverly devised stories here. We were eyewitnesses to the majesty of God." Tom Wright, writing about this, says, "As we learn to listen, even if sometimes we get scared and say really stupid things, as we learn to listen, we may find a glory strengthening us in our darkness." Well, the text, as we read it, said that when the disciples heard God's voice, they fell down on their faces and were terrified. But I want you to look at try to hear these next two verbs. So they're down on their faces, they're terrified, but Jesus came. Note that verb. And second, he touched them. Note that action. He came and he touched. Now, I don't know about you, but when I'm stuck in some bit of darkness, especially if it's mental or spiritual or emotional kind of darkness, often what accompanies that is a sense of Jesus not being with me. Right? So note again the verbs. Jesus came and he touched, saying to them, "Rise and have no fear." Now, again, that's not a scolding. That's an invitation into the reality that he always knows. This is implicit and harmonizes with Jesus' basic invitation to come follow me. Come follow me into this thing that's really real, and I'll teach you little by little how to have no fear in it. It shows us Jesus loving and gently caring for us amidst our dark fears and confusions, and how as a master, Jesus guided his apprentices. He gave context to their pain and interpreted their spiritual experiences for them. And I want to say he'll do the same today for anyone willing to pay attention. He will come and he will touch. And this, of course, is meant to give us the confidence to enter the core of our most honest experiences, our most honest existence or soul, and to be able to name what's really there. Without that confidence, that when we've fallen down and we're confused, without the confidence that Jesus will come and touch, then we will never actually have the confidence to kind of go there. But we can go there when we know that we go there with a compassionate God who already knows the kind of cold, drafty places in our hearts and minds. He already knows the, you know, the kind of the rooms in our heart that are dark. And he also knows kind of the sunrooms where our favorite chair is, and it's warm in that corner. He already knows. And so a major part of Christian spirituality, a major aspect of following Jesus, is learning to notice the fact that beyond the dull, muted, or grimy curtain of our painful emotional or physical or spiritual symptoms, there is always already a great light shining. That's what this intends, at least in the way I'm talking about this morning, it's what it intends to teach us. It's actually very important because the only alternative I'm aware of, and here I'll put it in the words of Henry Nouwen, the only other alternative is to do everything possible to avoid painful confrontations with our basic human brokenness. Whether that's loneliness or chronic pain or whatever it is. And without doing this, we then get ourselves trapped by false gods who promise immediate satisfaction and quick relief. Can you see the alternative here? One alternative is I have the guts to recognize what's real, and I have it because I believe that Jesus will come and touch and that he won't leave me alone. Or the other alternative is I fill my life to hide and to medicate my pain. That's one of our biggest false gods, I would say, and false approaches is busyness. It's certainly the one that I'm most aware of and I find the most handy. You know, it's not for no reason that Holy Trinity is quiet. And it's not for no reason that there are times of stillness and silence. And I know people aren't beating the doors down to get here, but I'm dying on this hill. I am not inventing another busy church meant to distract you from what's real. I can't do it with a clean conscience. We have to find spaces and places in our life in which that veil is pulled thin, and or to switch metaphors, we can use the telescope, or to switch metaphors again, to use the microscope, to notice with a confidence in Jesus' coming and touching what's really real. I had a colleague this week call for kind of coaching, mentoring, and this person was telling me about the out-of-control pace of their life and the busyness, and this person called me because this person had noticed in me what she thought was a really great way of handling a busy life. And I sort of chuckled to myself, like, well, I'm glad you think that. I'm doing my best. But this person went on to talk about, you know, I have one full-time job. I've got a second job. I'm a pastor. And as she was talking to me, I noticed this little piece of paper under the glass of my desk that I cut out from Eugene Peterson's memoir, The Pastor. And it's a quote by Melville from Moby Dick that says, The harpooners of this life must arise out of stillness. So you know the story of Moby Dick? Picture these big burly guys, you know, rowing and trying to get the boat in the right direction to get near enough to the whale to take a shot, you know, sweating, bulging muscles, pulling, straining. But the harpooner, the one who's going to do what the whole thing's all about, the one that who's going to execute on what the expedition is all about, he has to arise from stillness in order to take an accurate shot. Want to take an accurate shot at life? Want to take an accurate shot of being a husband or a wife or a friend or a mom or a dad, an employee or employer? Learn to arise from stillness. So I said to my friend, acting like the amateur spiritual director I am, I said to my friend, here's what I want you to do. I want you to just once or twice or three, whatever times a day, don't be legalistic about this, no judgment, no expectations, but here's what I want you to do. Even if it's only 10 or 20 or 30 seconds, whatever you can do, I want you to find a couple of times in your day to come to absolute stillness. Don't twitch a muscle. And just notice. Notice what happens. Notice what you think. Notice what you feel. Call me in a couple of weeks and we'll talk again. I mean, for me, this is how bad it is. You know, besides my little fastings for Lent, you know what else I'm doing for Lent? I'm trying to practice typing slower. Seriously. I mean, my mind races so fast. I can think like 7 or 8 times faster than I can type. And so I always try to keep up with that. And I just have noticed that it creates like this anxiety in me. And so I'm just like done with it. I'm tired of it. I said, I don't care. If you get an email from me 30 seconds later, wham. I am typing slower. It's just one of my little Lenten practices to remind myself that I am what Nouwen describes. And I want to say this really matters. For when we're busy and in a hurry, driven by thousands of different and conflicting stimuli, we become inhospitable as people. The way our lives seem to those outside of us is like a merry-go-round that's going around so fast. Remember that when you were a kid on the playground and the kids got it going so fast and you're just like, you can't see how to get on? That's how our lives begin to seem to others. There's no way in. There's no space. There's too much going on. So anyway, I want to conclude this little Lenten reflection on the Transfiguration by telling you something really cool I found or heard about this last week and then did some research on it this week. So I want to leave you with this little Lenten vision of the effect of God's real presence in our dark places through this Japanese form of art called kintsugi. Kintsugi is the Japanese art of repairing broken ceramic, like what we have here for communion. So picture one of these communion cups falling on concrete or something and shattering. Well, what these Japanese artists do is they repair these things by using a resin that's filled with gold powder. And they put them together as an artist, not like you fix a chip on your plate, you know, with super glue. They put these things back together like master artists. So they take all the fragmented pieces, and with this lacquer resin filled with this gold powder, they take this imperfect pot or bowl or cup, and they fix it such that it's more gorgeous and more precious and cherished than it was before it was fractured. In fact, this became such a trend in Japanese art and such a sort of almost elitist thing to have that people were actually breaking pottery to get one of these artists to go fix it. Because when they put it back together, it was actually more treasured than before it was fractured. People began to see it as a creative addition or a rebirth to the cup's life history. And having suffered damage and having a history, kintsugi means that when it's repaired, it's more beautiful than when it was flawless. You were made. And in our fallen nature, and in modern crazy life, we've all fallen and been broken. And God is mending. And the hope Jesus wanted his followers to see, that in this bright glory of God that exposes all of us as who we are, in Peter's case through these bumbling words, in your case, whatever, Jesus wants us to know that if you're willing to listen, if you're willing to come follow me, you'll be put back together in a way such that who you are will be more treasured by God than before you were broken. Amen.